Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Welcome to episode 69 of Talk Eastern Europe, a podcast dedicated to discussing issues related to Central and Eastern Europe and the official podcast of the New Eastern Europe magazine. This podcast is a listener-supported podcast, and our listeners donate to us via our Patreon page, for which we are extremely grateful. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, please support us at www.patreon.com/talkeasterneurope. And don't forget to listen to the end of this podcast for our traditional patron shout-out. My name is Adam Reichert, and with me is the other co-host of the podcast, Maciek Makulski. Hi, Maciek.
Hello, Adam. Hello, listeners. Thank you for joining us. Each week, we bring you an in-depth discussion on a topic related to our region. This week, we look at the memory of the Holocaust through an interview with an Israeli writer, whose book was recently published in Poland. As a reminder, Talk Eastern Europe is a member of the European Network, a network of podcasts which covers various views on political and social trends in Europe and beyond.
Thanks, Maciek. I'm really looking forward to this discussion, so let's get started on episode 69. So as we said in the opening of this episode, we are looking at a topic which is one actually that we haven't talked too much in terms of the podcast here at Talk Eastern Europe, and that's looking at issues related to memory and history, specifically the history and memory of the Second World War and the Holocaust, which of course is a huge issue which has always played a very important role in this region and this part of the world. And we are looking at it from a very interesting perspective. We are having a special interview with an author, an Israeli author, who wrote a book a few years ago, but it was just translated into Polish. The topic here in Poland is talked about quite a bit. And this is a book which is called Memory Monster, and it was written by an author named Yishai Sarid, who is an Israeli novelist, a lawyer, and author of 6 books. And the one that we are talking about was included on the New York Times list of 100 notable books of 2020. So Maciek, you did the interview and you also read the book. So maybe before we get into the discussion, maybe you could give us a brief overview of what Memory Monster is about and what you learned from it and why you think it is relevant to even the discussions that we have today.
Okay, thank you, Adam. Very briefly, first thing which was important for me when I was reading the book, I realized that it is, as you say, the topic is debated in Poland with different intensity depending on time, on some events or some political events, and to somehow this memory after Holocaust is shaping the relations between Poland and Israel. But what I realized when I was reading this book was that we rarely talk how the reconstruction of memory after Holocaust is taking place in Israel. We have we don't have too much discussion how what is the real impact of Holocaust in today Israel, and this book explains it, I think, very well. It's really good overview for me of the state of the debate or debates, because it doesn't have to be just one debate, in Israel about this topic. And you know, this is a tiny book, less than 200 pages. You can, if you like, you can really read it within one evening. And I think this is one of the strength of this book, because you don't have to go through details, dates, you know, different studies which were conducted by many scientists, because it's not a scientific book. It has like a report style book, which means that the book is a report written by a man who works as a guide hired by Yad Vashem Center in Israel, and his job is mainly to guide tours of teenagers, not only teenagers but mainly teenagers from Israel in Poland, and they visit you know, different death camps that were located in the territory of Poland under the German occupation. So this is his task. There, in the beginning of the book, we learn that there was an incident during his work, and he has to like provide explanation for his supervisor about this, just to explain his perspective. And you know, if you listen, if you have in mind something like that, you imagine rather like maybe 2-3 pages of report, like stating some basic facts, what happened, and so on. But for the main protagonist of the book, this report has become kind of, you know, reconstruction again for himself, what the memory of Holocaust did to him, did to his mind, to his mentality. Because you must know that he went into this memory, into the past, very, very deep. I even called him an extreme case, because not all people like think so often, so intense about the past as he did. So he's an extreme case, but the memory monster from the title is
right.
Is exactly, you know, what happened to him. That if you are so dependent on the thinking about the past, it might, you know, on the one hand, you know a lot about this, the past, about the history, which is good. You increase your own knowledge, you can share the knowledge with others, you have better understanding of what happened. But on the same time, it can really hurt you, yeah. And I think the author is telling us that we can't really fight the memory monster, or if we try to fight the memory monster, we are only always on a position from which it is very difficult to win. And in fact, we are not sure after reading the book what happens next to the protagonist, which is, I think, also quite interesting play or quite interesting solution that the author decided to adapt. And maybe one more thing before we go to interview, because
sure.
I don't want to, you know, talk too much about the plot, because, as you said, the book is available in Polish, but it's also available in English and other languages.
Right.
So I hope some...
And we'll link to it in the podcast notes. Yeah, we'll link to it in the notes.
Yeah, great. So I really recommend our listeners to read this book. But yeah, I was also interested how this book was received in Israel, and I think he explains that in the interview. But I would like to reinforce that statement that it's this book caused like more controversies. Maybe it's not the best word here, but more debate simply.
Yeah. Yeah.
Internationally, in US, for instance, than in Israel, which maybe I'm not a specialist about Israelis politics or social issues or even debate on this, but maybe it also tells us something that how Israelis try to, you know, live normal life in the shadow of this cruel past.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, the interview, and we'll go to it in a moment, so I won't give much away, but it's a very interesting interview. And you guys talk not only about the book, you actually go deeper into a lot of this mentality, Israeli mentality, the mentality of this region towards memory and history of the Holocaust, and a lot of the challenges that still exist today. So I think it's a really good discussion. And Maciek, thank you so much for giving us an overview of the book. For those who are interested, we just published the latest issue of New Eastern Europe, and Maciek's review of that book is also available in that issue. So we will link to it as well for those who want to read more about the book. So Maciek, with that, I think your brief overview of the book gives us the context for our discussion. So let's now go in to the interview, your interview with Yishai Sarid, the author of Memory Monster.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Joining me now is Yishai Sarid, an Israel novelist, lawyer, and the author of 6 books. His book, The Memory Monster, the one we want to discuss today, was included in the New York Times list of 100 notable books of 2020. Hello, Yishai. Welcome to Talk Eastern Europe.
Thank you very much.
I would like to start our conversation with a question about the concept of memory itself, which is, as I think, a key one in your book, Memory Monster. Why did you decide to write a book about memory?
Well, you know, the issue of the Shoah, of the Holocaust, is a very central issue in my life personally, in Israeli's life, in Jewish people's life. So there's no question why I decided to write about it. It's quite natural. You know, my family, most of my parents, grandparents were, and most of their families were murdered in the Holocaust. So it's very personal. And also collectively, it's an issue of the Israeli collective. It's a very prominent issue, because it doesn't fade away. It influences, I think, almost every aspect of our lives.
So I have read some reviews and articles about perception of your novel, and some people, I think a lot of people, may look at it through the prism of personal experience, as you already said, and or our experience of a given community of people, and this is natural. But your book, which has a form of a written report of an employee to his supervisor, in which he has described an incident that took place during his work, but the report turns out to be a confession of what work related to the reconstruction of the memory of the Holocaust did him. And it brought me some reflections about how the mechanism of being obsessed with a memory might work. And I want to ask whether, looking from that perspective, your book is also quite universal. It is about Holocaust, but in a way Holocaust is a context, a background for the novel, not the main theme. I would like to ask you about those your reflections about it.
Well, I think you're right, but you know, as a novelist, I don't start from this point. I write a story. So I'm not thinking in advance about the influence or the, you know, the universal meaning and such things. If you ask me retrospectively, well, I think so, because of course the trauma of the Holocaust is unique and the magnitude of the Holocaust is unique, but different societies and nations in the world face dilemmas and arguments about how to deal with the past. You know, I've been with this book, for example, in Spain, in Catalonia, about a year ago. And they told me they have a big issue with the Franco years, with the fascist years there, how to commemorate it, you know, not commemorating enough, whether to commemorate it, how do you do it? So these are common questions for different societies. And also, of course, what lessons we learn from those terrible phenomena in history about our lives today and about the future. And that's a common thing because, you know, we see nowadays fascism rising again, anti-Semitism, racism in general, and how we use or how we remember the past as a tool to deal with what's happening nowadays.
Let's talk about it a bit more, how we also use memory, because the novel protagonist's profession is guiding school groups around death camps that were located in today Poland. Such a profession might be viewed as the politics of memory put into practice, I think. And I want to ask you, what is your general take on the concept of politics of memory? Because on the one hand, it is important because it might contribute to strengthening a nation's identity, bonds between people. This is common experience. But on the other hand, it has a potential to cause misunderstandings between people, sometimes between the whole societies or nations. So I am curious if you have any reflections about politics of memory.
Well, first of all, I don't want to speak about places and the societies whom I don't know enough. So I'll talk about our lives. Of course, very important to remember the Holocaust because, you know, these are our families, our people that were murdered there. And you cannot forget it and you don't want to forget it. Now, the question is how you forget it and for what objectives you use the memory. That's the difficult question. Do you remember the victims as individuals? Do you study or teach, you know, young people or students about their lives, the lives they had and lost in the Holocaust? Or whether you treat them as one giant collective of 6 million, you know, which makes it less personal and less human because you cannot, you know, 6 million is a number. You don't see faces, you don't hear the voices when you just talk about 6 million. And the essay write in the book, there are many, many aspects of Israel nowadays that relate to it. How do you deal with the issue of force? Because my personal experience, I participated twice in such journeys. First time was in 1983 when Poland was still under communist regime. It was General Jaruzelski's time as the ruler of Poland. Mm-hmm. And then I was 18 years old. It was a few months before going to the army. And, you know, it was one of the, maybe the first such delegation in modern time. It was very adventurous. You know, Poland in such days was, you couldn't travel to Poland ordinarily.
Yeah.
And there was a young man, you know, I was a very young man. And I can tell about myself that when I came back to Israel and people asked me, what lesson did you learn from this journey? I told them, that we have to be strong again, that it will not happen to us again. We have to be very strong. Now, that's, of course, a very important lesson for Jewish people after the Holocaust. And indeed, I served in the army for almost 6 years. I was an officer in the army. I think part of it was, part of the motivation was this journey when we, you know, they took us to Auschwitz and other places. But, you know, that's, and that's the almost the exclusive lesson that young people come back from Poland with also nowadays with those delegations. Now, the second time I went to Poland was in 2015 when I made the research for this book. And I took a car from Warsaw Airport and went through almost all the German extermination camps in Poland. It was completely different from my first experience. It was, you know, I have a family, I have children, and suddenly all the things came to me and I almost saw them in my eyes, all the horror. And it was emotional, it was very, very hard. So, and then I started writing this book. So it's a big difference how a boy or a girl being 17 or 18 years old grasp this history and those memories and how grown-ups grasp them. And when you take them on those delegations when they are very young, very close to the recruitment to the army, it many times serves motivations which to my mind are, outside. It's not the real thing. It's not the center of the thing, because those places are meant to mourn the loss, the terrible loss of human lives, the results of fascism and anti-Semitism and racism, to learn the humanistic, the human lessons of the Holocaust. And so and not so much use them as a motivation for other things. I think that's now that's just an example. You have many, many other aspects of the abuse of memory for political reasons. For example, you had about a year ago the big conference in Yad Vashem under the name of Yad Vashem, where our Prime Minister Netanyahu hosted many leaders from the world. And, you know, there was some twist of history there and it wasn't accurate enough for political reasons, for different political reasons. And that's, of course, wrong.
Talking a bit beyond your book, I want to refer to what you have already started to describe this today's perspective or today perception of this tragic history of the 20th century, but I would like to focus on the perception of the young generation in Israel, because one may think that the portrait you draw in the book is quite critical, because young people from your book are not always deeply interested in what they see, or sometimes forced in a way by the guy to draw some conclusions from the tours, from these delegations. And you have also your personal experience about that, which I think is also important here. And I must admit that in a way, I understand that these young people, because a school delegation, school trip might not be the best way to learn about such difficult topics for everyone. I mean that some people simply need to go through it individually, not as a group. So the question is whether you wanted to know the attention of a reader to the issue of a perception of the past today. Was it your aim?
Yeah, of course. You know, that's the advantage and the value of writing literature and not, you know, pieces in the newspaper or academic stuff. Because in literature, you can stuff in everything and also things that are not politically correct and not always coherent also. You know, you can write also your thoughts that are not so pleasant and not so nice to hear. And they put everything there. I didn't censorship myself. Yeah, and my intention was, first of all, to reflect what's going in my mind, in my head regarding this subject. And then talk about the difficulties, you know, those delegations that are kind of passage right for Israeli youngsters. And I don't have much criticism regarding the young people. You know, what do you want from them? You take very young people at high school with their friends going abroad. They want to have fun, you know, and then you tell them you shouldn't laugh, you shouldn't have fun, you shouldn't, you know, go out at night from the hotel, etc., etc. So it puts them, you must be sad, you must weep. So it puts them in an impossible situation. And the whole issue of memory and how we remember the Holocaust, I think, should be different. We don't know enough about the life of those people, of our ancestors. If you ask a person in the street, tell me something about the Holocaust victim, he'll probably tell you one name we know about, which is Anna Frank, which is very important, but there are many, many others who we don't know anything about their lives. And they were all people who had, you know, families and personal life and love stories and profession and hobbies. And, you know, they were people. And while we visit, we put the focus on those terrible extermination camps. In a way, we do them injustice because we meet them only in the last and final and terrible stop in their lives. After they've been humiliated and starved and beaten, etc., etc. So that's not so fair to them, to those victims.
One reason we are talking about this book is that the Polish translation has just been published in Poland, but the book, you wrote the book in 2017, if I am correct, so it is already some years ago. And I want to ask how it was received in Israel. Did you have any debates about this book that were somehow difficult for you?
No, it's very interesting because this book was already translated to quite a few languages. I don't know, maybe 6, 7, 8 so far. Whenever I go abroad with him, or used to go abroad, or speak before the pandemic, or speak with people like I speak with you, I understand that outside Israel, it's considered to be a very provocative book. And it wasn't perceived like this in Israel. Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting because I think in Israel, the discussion about the Holocaust is much more free than outside Israel, because we can allow ourselves, you know, to open the subject and say things that other people, other nations cannot speak. So that wasn't the main focus, but I can tell you, for example, that Yad Vashem very much disliked this book. Mm-hmm. Got all kinds of messages from them that they don't like it, which is, you know, disappointing, and it's a pity because Yad Vashem is a very important organization. I have criticism about some aspects of what they are doing, but it's a very, very important body. Most of the activities are very crucial for remembering the Holocaust. And also my protagonist, you know, he writes to the chairman of Yad Vashem as a father figure. He very much respects him.
Of course.
That's the whole thing, so... But they didn't like it. But most of the readers, you know, were not shocked by anything I wrote there. It's the reality of those journeys is quite widely known in Israel. You know, it's not the first time that this
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Reality is portrayed in Israel.
Yeah, probably the most shocking, if I may use that word, moment in the book is when a student ends at the school trip, this delegation, one of this delegation, with a conclusion referring to today, and the conclusion is, I guess we have to be a bit of nazi in order to survive, end quote, but it's my working translation. And it's a powerful constatation. And I must admit that when I read this sentence, I had to do a short break before I continued reading your book. And the question here I have is, can you give us some your reflections on what's behind that way of thinking about the experience stemming from the Holocaust?
Yeah, it's an issue of how you defend yourself and how you live in this cruel world. Because, you know, Jewish people were defenseless. We didn't have an army. Most of Jewish people didn't know how to hold a gun, you know, or a rifle. And it ended then the way it ended, you know, with almost a complete annihilation of the Jews in Europe and also in some other places. So after it's such a trauma that your first instinct that I have to be very strong now, that it will not happen again. And that's very natural and, you know, justified. But to what extent you go with this instinct? What measures you allow yourself to take in order to defend yourself? And that's an issue we face in Israel on a daily basis. How much force we use against our neighbors, against our enemies? What kind of risk we can take? Can we take any risk, or whether we cannot take any risk when it involves our security? And then there's the precedent of the Second World War, which you cannot wipe out, you cannot delete it. It's there to stay. And some people tell, you know, and write about it in Israel. We have to be absolutely cruel, heartless, and, you know, free of morals in order to defend ourselves, okay? Mm-hmm. Because what happened to us? Because we were such victims, so it will happen only once and it will not happen again. And therefore, we can do anything to defend ourselves, including killing civilians, including etc. Now, that's not the general. It's not a consensus in Israel, but those are voices that are heard, and not by one or it's not such a small minority. It's you hear it all the time. We have to be very cruel. We have to be ruthless, etc., etc. If somebody attacks us, because of what happened to us. So it reflects a real thought in Israeli society. And there is also the issue of when, you know, because I'm not a religious person, but let's say for the, thanks God, we're not weak anymore. We're very strong. You know, we are very armed. Almost every Israeli knows how to operate a rifle. We have the most sophisticated weapons in the world, etc., etc. All of this is a very good thing. But our psychology many times is still over there when we were very weak and helpless. So what happens when, you know, it's like a person who was a weak and a weak boy, everybody beated him and humiliated him, and he grows to be a very strong person, but his psychology is still of this small and weak boy. So it raises a lot of questions, like I ask in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's really great advantage of your book, that you present many points of view or simple standpoints how Holocaust is discussed today, and the one we've just discussed about this being ruthless to defend yourself and simply not allow to happen something similar again, which sounds like impossible, but of course we should remember about it all the time. So yeah, I think that's if I were to recommend your book, which I'm doing right now, this is for me very important thing, that this is a collection of different ways how the Holocaust appears in public discussions, as I understand.
Right.
I want also to ask about a sensitive issue from a Polish perspective, but I don't want to go into politics here, but I want to take an occasion that you are aware how Holocaust is located within a public discourse in Poland. We have some problems in our public discussion about it, and I'm sure you are aware of it, but there is this term Polish death camps that appears from time to time in a public debate, and it was used several times by influential figures, including politicians, and Poland tries to fight such terminology, which may suggest to a non-informed person that the death camps were indeed Polish and not just located in the territory of Poland. And the question is, if there is awareness in Israel of this Polish perspective about this issue?
It's a very problematic issue, because the source of this problem is that there is no real dialogue between Israelis and the Polish people about this subject.
True.
And therefore, it's like a wound that doesn't heal, but just, you know, grows bigger and more hurtful. If there was a dialogue, so I think things would be different. And from an Israeli perspective, Poland never did the soul searching necessary to deal with the lessons and the memory of Polish history, especially regarding the Jewish people of the Second World War, of the Holocaust. Now, it doesn't start with the war, you know, because the whole subject of Polish life in Poland is something which should be discussed, because there are different ways to view it. You know, as a matter of fact, it was a prosperous and very talented community, a large community, which was before the war, about 3.5 million, maybe more than this, Jewish people living in Poland. But the history of 1,000 years of Jewish life in Poland is, you know, is not one-sided or black or white, but there were also very dark chapters in it, of pogroms, of false accusations against Jewish people, of humiliation. I can tell you as a personal thing that my grandmother, my mother's mother, she grew up in Lvov, mm-hmm. which used today to be Poland. Today it's in Ukraine, but when she lived there, it used to be a Polish territory. And she came to Israel. It was then Palestine in 1935. She was 19 years old, and she came to Israel because she couldn't get admitted to a Polish university because of the numerous clauses that used to be on those days before the war, without connection to the Germans, in Polish universities. And she was a talented, you know, she was a wise and a clever girl, but she couldn't get admitted to any Polish university. So it's a difficult history, but nevertheless, we share, you know, we share a common history. Mm-hmm. Yes, we lived in for many, many centuries in Poland. Now, when you get to the history of the, when you go to the Holocaust, of course, it must be said, and there is no historical doubt about it, the extermination camps were not Polish camps, they were German camps. And that I emphasize in my book. They were not built by the Polish people. They were not administered by Polish people. They were not operated by Polish people. So that's a complete twist of history to say Polish death camps. These were German death camps, which were built intentionally outside Germany, not to pollute, and not to to put it somewhere in the east where it will not, this dirty business will not be on German soil. But on the same time, we shouldn't ignore the dark pages or chapters in behavior of some, not maybe some, maybe many Polish people during the war. You know, we know that even through the war, there were quite a few Polish collaborators. There were pogroms during the war and immediately after the war. So it wasn't, we cannot say, you know, cannot exonerate all Polish people. And say, you know, we read in history that there was a very deep-rooted anti-Semitism in Poland for many years, which went also through those years. Many Polish people were quite happy about what the Germans are doing to the Jewish people, even though they didn't. It wasn't, the Holocaust was not a Polish enterprise. But at the same time, we must commemorate and remember about 7,000 Polish people were recognized by Yad Vashem as righteous among the nations, non-Jewish Poles, mm-hmm. who risked their lives and the lives of their families and saved lives of Jewish people, which is, of course, we don't speak enough about it.
Yeah.
So the whole issue of Jewish-Polish relations, not just from the Holocaust, but many years before, it's something which is not discussed enough from my point of view, our point of view. Poland, you know, made things too easy for Poland, you know. Say we were also conquered or
occupied.
By the Germans, which is of course true. So we are also victims like the Jewish people were, and you shouldn't blame us on everything. That's wrong. That's history. That's contrary to history. On the other side, Polish people are not responsible for the Holocaust. So this is something that should be discussed, but the political and maybe not just political, but also the cultural atmosphere is such that there is no dialogue, which is absolutely necessary here. And I hope that this book maybe will contribute something, you know, for this dialogue.
Yeah, that was exactly what I wanted to say, that I want to express here a hope that your book will contribute to further discussion about this, and maybe will help to develop better relations and better discussion, in fact, between Poland and Israel about that. I think literature has this power to do such a things. Of course, there is a debate in Poland about this, but now it's a very dividing thing, yeah, dividing topic.
But I think it's important that you should hear also Jewish and Israeli voices in this debate, you know.
Mm-hmm. Of course, you are right.
Because Poland or Polish people need to understand that as long as Poland describes itself as, a complete victim who has no blame and no nothing, it just strengthens its image in Jewish and Israeli eyes as responsible for the Holocaust. You know, it's exactly the contrary.
Mm-hmm.
So we must have a dialogue. It's a grown-up people, you know.
Exactly.
That's very important.
Exactly as you said, and I think we are referring to the issue we discussed earlier, this instrumentalization of memory here, and then the discussion comes to, you know, numbers, and we forget about people behind that, yeah, which I think is the most important thing. It's more important than statistics, yeah. This personal experience, as you said, it is important for you, it's important for a lot of people here in Poland and in Israel. So yeah,
I read a few years ago a biography of Janusz Korczak,
mm-hmm.
written by the famous Polish Jewish teacher, educator, was murdered by with his pupils, with the children in the Holocaust. And it's heartbreaking to see how he wanted to be accepted as a Polish person, Polish citizen, you know, a complete one. He saw himself as an integral part of Polish society, but he was not really accepted, you know. That's the very sad things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a real, real tragedy. And it's complicated because there are many... The situation today in which Poland and Israel... Not in, you know, political and diplomatic stuff, but culturally and emotionally, are almost detached from each other. It's very sad. It's very sad. We spent many years together.
Mm-hmm. You're right, Ishai. That was quite a journey through tough and sensitive issues. But first of all, I hope we attract our listeners to read your book, which is available in many languages, not only in Polish. But in the end, I would like to ask you about, maybe can you reveal some your future plans about your next books, about or other projects you might be involved in? Of course, The Memory Monster is not the most recent book,
yeah,
you've wrote. But yeah, maybe you can say something about your plans.
My most recent book, which was published in Israel a few months ago, is called Victorious. It's a story of a military psychologist who trains combat soldiers how to be more effective in combat.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning how to kill better in combat. And she also treats soldiers who suffer from PTSD, from traumas from the wars. And her son is being recruited to the army, and she has close relations with the chief of staff of Israeli army. That's my latest,
mm-hmm.
Which will be also translated to several languages, I think, in the next year or so. And further plans, well, I have them, but I'm not, you know, I'm not working right now on the next book. It will take a while.
Okay. Thank you, Ishai, for joining Talk Instead Europe.
Thank you very much.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
And that was Maciek's interview with Yishai Sarid, Israeli novelist and author of the book Memory Monster. We have links to it in both English and Polish edition in this podcast if you're interested in learning more about it. Maciek, thanks for conducting this interview. I thought it was really interesting, the different topics that you touched on. But especially this topic of memory and the trauma of war and how it has shaped Israeli mindset today. I thought it was interesting how he talked about the fact that he kind of used this metaphor of someone who's being picked on as or being bullied, basically, as a child. And then finally they realize that the only way to be able to never repeat getting bullied is to become really strong yourself. And this was quite something that came out in the book as well, as you mentioned, that was a little controversial, with one of the younger participants saying that the only way to really defeat a kind of Nazis is to become a bit of a Nazi yourself. And that was quite interesting.
Yeah, for me it was like the first climax of the book. Really, when I have read this sentence, I was shocked. I must say that also had an impression during the interview that this is what Sarit thinks. Yeah, that this is probably he thinks. Yeah, that this is the effective strategy in dealing with memory and all threats that are there for Israel today. But he, I think, is fair enough, because in this book, I forgot to mention that in the beginning, is also kind of an overview of different standpoints, different points of view, different approaches, how people simply live with this trauma or with this memory. And, you know, not all are such, you know, not all people, of course, think about it every day. Yeah? And you know, we also have this perspective from teenagers who are not interested in learning about that. And it's also, of course, understandable from a point for me. I don't think so that for me it would be the best way to learn about Holocaust just to go with my colleagues for a trip. If you go for such a trip as a teenager, you probably think about different things. Yeah. But the most important thing for me here is that this book can work as kind of, you know, list of approaches that exist in Israel, how this working on memory can look like.
Yeah,
and from that point of view, sorry, Adam, this is more universal, because, you know, it's other nations, other societies, other communities of people have, you know, other traumas, yeah, and it can work in similar way, yeah. It doesn't apply, I think, only to Holocaust, yeah.
Yeah, that's true. And I do appreciate that the discussion that you had also, and Yishai's point of view on Poland and Israel still need dialogue. There needs to be, you know, more discussions about overcoming this trauma of memory. And unfortunately, a lot of people just don't want to discuss the deeper issues. So I think it was also a good point that you brought up and that you discussed with him in the interview.
He surprised me how well he knows the different, you know, understandings of problems about, you know, this past in Poland, how it is debated in Poland. He understands that, and I think he is a good example he gives good examples how this dialogue can look like. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, thanks again for that. It was a very interesting discussion. You know, looking at history and memory issues is something that's so important in this region, and we don't cover it so often in Talk Eastern Europe. So it's good that we have this discussion here. I think now we can move on to the announcements side of the podcast. Maciek, do you have any announcements you want to bring up before we go into the final, most important announcement?
Yeah, I will steal one announcement from you, but of course I will also allow you to talk more about that, because the very important issue for me, New Eastern Europe is upcoming, the one which is devoted to Baltic Sea region, three Baltic Sea republics actually. And as you said, I contributed a bit to this issue, and I think it has really, really interesting content, which explains the region, this part of the region, from very different angles. So not only politics, but a lot, of course, about politics, but also some more about social issues. And we have very good opening interview because we managed to sit with former Foreign Minister of Lithuania, Linas Linkevičius, and of course listeners of Talk Eastern Europe had already occasion to listen to this interview, but those who prefer also printed version, they can also now have access to the printed interview. But Adam, you are editor-in-chief, so I think the last word about the upcoming issue should be yours.
Thanks. And I really am really satisfied with this issue. I think it came together really nicely. We haven't done an issue on the Baltics in a while. I think the last time was maybe like 2015, possibly. Sure. So we decided not to focus on the geopolitics or the security issues in the region, because those are ones that we cover a lot. We wanted to look, as you said, look at some other aspects, some other angles. And we wanted to kind of get stories from the Baltic states 30 years after the fall of the Soviet Union. And I think what we do show is that a lot of the processes that are taking place in the Baltics now are very much like similar processes taking place in other Western European countries. So it shows the integration of Baltic states successfully from regaining independence after being a part of the Soviet Union and then joining NATO and the European Union. They are clearly a part of and integrated of those structures. So that's what I think the story is really put together. And there's a lot of other great stuff in here. If we go beyond the Baltics, we have some good pieces about the situation in Russia with the Navalny protests. We have texts on also Ukraine and especially the recent developments in Ukraine. We have a couple pieces on Georgian politics, very interesting one by Mackenzie Baldinger, who was on the podcast a few months ago. She wrote a piece about the debt crisis in Georgia, so very interesting. And some, of course, the book reviews and your review of The Memory Monster, which was featured in this episode of Talk Eastern Europe. So if you're interested in learning more about the issue, there's a link in the notes to this to this podcast, but you can also visit neweasterneurope.eu.
One more thing from me. I think already the cover of this issue could inspire the whole discussion about the transformation of all three Baltic republics for last 30 years. It's really good cover made by Andrzej Zaremba.
Yes. A
great artist who usually prepares all graphics and covers for New Eastern Europe.
Yeah, I really love this cover. This one really, the colors and the drawing really came together nicely. Yeah, Andrzej is great. And we have, I think, three illustrations inside the issue as well. So you can check that out.
Those who are interested in New Eastern Europe and are not yet patron of Talk Eastern Europe, they, I think, can combine these two opportunities, because by becoming a patron may give you, if you chosen a proper plan, may give you access actually to printed or digital version of the New Eastern Europe.
What a great transition, Maciek, to the patrons. Exactly. We have a couple different options. If you want to support this podcast, and we're reaching our 70th episode, which is quite amazing. I'm really happy and surprised that we managed to, keep this podcast going. But we're building a community on Patreon with patrons who give us money to support the podcast, and you get extra benefits in return. So if you are a $10 a month or more supporter, you get a PDF copy of the latest issue of New Eastern Europe. And if you're a $20 a month or more supporter, you get full access to our digital database of New Eastern Europe. So I definitely recommend you, if you are not a patron and you are interested in supporting the podcast and getting some great content, which is exclusive and only found by being a subscriber or patron, head over to our Patreon page at patreon.com/talkeasterneurope. And of course, the other benefit, which everyone gets as a thank you for your support, is our traditional shout out on the podcast. And we are currently at 32 patrons. It's where we've been for a while, but it's great that we are not losing anybody, and we'd love to add a few more to the list. But just allow me to say hello and thank you to all of our patrons, including Pierre, Stephanie, Mark, Jason, Janos, Erica, Elizabeth, David, Wilhelm, Scapegoast, Sophia, Ian, Urs, Pavel, William, Anastasia, David, Sean, Elise, JP, Naomi, Sean, Plowman, Klaus, Pat, CB, Marina, Lorenzo, Jane, Anastasia, Ian, and Olaf. Thank you so much for your support of the podcast. And stay tuned. We also have special Zoom meetings, discussions, which are exclusive for our patrons. And I think we are hoping to plan one yet this month, before the end of this month.
Yeah, and I think we will take the opportunity that, or we will simply use the fact that we have this special Baltic issue, and we will invite someone from, I don't know, Latvia, Lithuania, or Estonia. So yeah, this is another good occasion to get a little bit more about this part of the region.
Exactly, exactly. Okay, well, that's all we have for today. So thank you so much for listening to this episode of Talk Eastern Europe. Stay tuned. We got several more being developed in the next week or two. So we will be back shortly with the next episode.
Thank you for today. Thank you for listening. Until next time.
Bye-bye.
Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky?
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.